Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. I'm Phil Carroll.
And I'm Kevin Hornsby.
Sunday the 14th of January. First roast in season 7. Season 7, Kev, episode 330. Some going in that.
I tell you what, we've talked to a lot of people.
It'd probably take you a year and a half to listen to the whole back catalogue, if you'd ever want to do that, of course.
I think you'd be dead before you... I think you'd want to do that. So that. Be interesting to listen to a few of the early ones and then move on and see how the whole situation has changed. I think
see how the landscape has changed over the last 2.5 years in terms of companies, etc. Some that are probably no longer even listed on the market. Some that have gone from strength to strength, and some that have gone backwards, no doubt.
And even the way we've done things, we've changed how we do things. So it's developed and developing. I think as time goes by.
So good start to the new year so far. Any big changes there? Anything going on in terms of, you know, life-wise?
Just moving apartments now to all our new apartments, finished, moving this weekend. So, yeah, children are very excited to have their own bedrooms. It's all good. So, yeah.
Good. It sounds like good progress. Glad you're moving in. It's a bit of a stressful time, but I'm sure you'll get through it and, you know, it's not too bad. Anyway, let's have a look at the week that was. The one story that has dominated the news in the UK is obviously the Post Office accounting scandal. The Post Office scandal has been in the public domain for years. Private Eye magazine, the journalist and author Nick Wallace, and the BBC have been covering the story, but most Britons were not that bothered, really. But now, thanks to a mini-series entitled Mr. Bates versus the Post Office, it seems that everyone cares and wants action. I suppose better late than never. So Nick Wallace and the DDB have been covering the story. Most Britons were not that bothered. And more than 1 million people have signed a petition calling for Paula Venables, the Post Office chief executive at the time, to be stripped of a CBE. And obviously she handed that back on Tuesday. There's also growing fury about Fujitsu, the Japanese IT firm which designed the faulty Horizon accounting software. And arguments are raging about whether there is a way of quashing all of the convictions and compensating the victims in a quick fashion. So obviously legislation will be introduced to exonerate all of the sub-postmasters who are wrongly convicted amid the Post Office scandal. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said a new law would be introduced so people wrongly convicted in the scandal are swiftly exonerated and compensated. I mean, how does this work in terms of potentially there may be some guilty people that are exonerated out of the 900 odd claims of fraud? There may be one or two that have actually stolen from them. 600 grand potential payout to the guilty. Is it okay for one or two to get off scot-free for the sake of thousands who didn't?
Yes.
Right, is the answer. Come on, elaborate on that then.
Not really elaborate. You can't go with a broad brush like that. I don't know the full details of what's happened and what the situation is, so nobody wrong with me to comment, but just on a basis that we're not going to have a system where everybody who is guilty of things gets caught. It doesn't happen in life and in reality, does it? So and there's so many people who got caught who were innocent, if you like, got caught in the net, if you like, or the trap, whatever it was. This is not right.
So if anyone hasn't seen it, and I urge you to watch it as well. I know it's difficult over in Egypt because of sort of geolocation, the fact that you probably are blocked from accessing things like ITV and BBC, but if you can somehow get around that, maybe when you're older you can download it. Basically, the series was run. It was a four-part series. It went out between Christmas and New Year. Mr. Bates versus the Post Office. And I really do urge people to watch it. I guarantee that after the first episode, you will be apoplectic with rage about how these sub-postmasters were treated by the Post Office and literally were created as criminals, you know, just from accountancy errors. You know, they would do the money at the end of the day, they'd do the till, and then they'd find out that there's a discrepancy of, say, £1,000, and then they'd press something to a button to re-scan it and rejig it, and then there'd be £2,000, and then they press it again, and there'd be £4,000 in deficit. And all of a sudden, they had nobody from this Horizon computer system sort of support who could go there and sit down with them and say, let's work out what this bug was or whether there is a problem. It was a case of, you're the first person to have called when actually ultimately there was thousands of people that were calling up the support line and were being told that they were the first to have reported it. So utterly, yeah, frustrating, rage-inducing. And fair play to the media, you know, that it's come under the spotlight. Whoever wrote the screenplay did a fantastic job, because we've seen some of the real-life people who've come on, like Alan Bates and Lee Castleton, who were effective, and they were portrayed so well as almost identical to the way that they were in real life by these actors. And all of a sudden, the media... Do you think power of the media, they can kind of make or break people, they can kill people's career off, get people cancelled, but when they use the power of the media for the good, it just shows you how quickly that they can introduce laws, right?
Yeah, I think the press can be used positively, but more often than not, it's used negatively, isn't it? And this is the problem. It's the problem with our press, full stop. Even if it was balanced, you know, 50-50 or 60-40 or whatever, that, you know, people weren't always getting knocked down, then we would be in a much better situation. But we are in a cancel culture,
yeah,
where it seems to be okay to say whatever you want about whoever, you know, just because you don't like them.
Yeah. Yeah. And then ironically, they cancelled her, didn't they? It's Paula Venables. She's effectively been cancelled in the sense that she's had to rescind, or she's had to basically give back her CBE. And because of the pressure that's been put on her from, obviously, the likes of the Daily Mail, I'm sure she's had a lot of people on the phone to her, you know, probably threats in the street. You know, she probably can't even leave her house until she's done that. And even going forward, her life is almost ruined in that respect, isn't it? Because she'll always be remembered for not being the CEO of the post office, but for being the woman who you know, ran the post office and ultimately was responsible, you know, that they complicit in it in terms of the way they treated these innocent victims. So yeah, so one other story that's dominated the news towards the end of the week was that the war continuing in the Middle East, spilling over. Obviously, we heard the news that the UK and the US carried out targeted strikes against Houthi rebels in Yemen, with the PM Rishi Sunak stating that these strikes are necessary and proportionate to protect global shipping in the Red Sea. Rishi Sunak accused the Iranian-backed Houthi group of threatening UK ships. The strikes are in response to Houthi attacks on international shipping in the Red Sea and are aimed at degrading Houthi military capabilities. The action is seen as self-defense, with support from countries like the Netherlands, Canada and Bahrain. Labour Party leader Keir Starmer also supports the action, while the SNP and Liberal Democrats call for parliamentary scrutiny. Houthi officials warn of consequences, and Russia requests a UN Security Council meeting. The situation threatens global shipping and could impact inflation and interest rates. And also, the strikes against Houthis draw Britain and America closer to confrontation with Iran. What are your thoughts on the way that that's... We said it would escalate, or it would have the propensity to escalate, and here we are now, probably 3 months on from the initial incursion with the Hamas attacks, and you've got the Houthis saying, well, we've got to stop these attacks on Hamas, and when in reality, they're launching attacks on boats that had nothing to do with the Israelis. They're launching attacks on any shipping vessel that's running through the Red Sea.
Yeah, it's just so many proxy different wars, isn't it? You know, the Houthi rebels are being financed by Iran. This is clear. It's a much bigger picture than maybe anyone can see, I believe. I don't agree with what's happening in Gaza. I think it is genocide, whether we like it or not. I think the silence of our governments in terms of letting Israel basically do whatever they wish is wrong, and will be seen as wrong by history in the future, I think.
Yeah.
But it is what it is, isn't it? They've got to sort of toe the line, and it seems to be, okay, well, this is affecting money, oil, shipping, so therefore we will act. And that's what's happened. I think you can say very contentious things, and you can say things that people may agree or may not agree with in this situation. I think we're heading towards escalation. I think the Lebanese thing is more worrying than this, in my view, because I think basically if it opens up on that Lebanese border front, then we're not just going to have Gaza war, we're going to have a Lebanese war. Beirut will be flattened again.
Yeah, I mean, you look at it like that, as you say, look at the north, look at the way it can escalate into Beirut, you look at the way it could escalate eastwards into the likes of, as you say, now Iran could get involved when that you've got a proxy war, then you've got Saudi getting involved as well, you know what I mean? It's like it could go spread throughout. And you must also be seeing Egypt, because obviously the Suez Canal, with the when you look at the way that the ships are rerouted down effectively the Cape of Good Hope, effectively adding something like £1.3 million in fuel costs to each one of these vessels. I mean, that's a massive amount of fuel costs, an extra one. But no wonder prices and they're concerned about inflation and interest rates because of the fact you've got extra shipping costs and, you know, it all has a knock-on effect. But surely Egypt, in terms of employment, trade, all the values that come in through that, those ships that are going through that Suez Canal, it must be having an impact on Egypt for sure.
No, Egypt's crying because one of its main foreign currency issues is the Suez Canal and what the ships have to pay. So yeah, it's crying, and it's already crying because it's got a currency crisis of its own anyway, regardless of anything else that's going on.
Yeah.
So there is so many multiple knock on effects.
Yeah.
It's impossible, I think, for anyone to understand. I think over the break, I listened to a 25-hour, six-session podcast. It was called the Martyr Made Podcast, and it was going back in history, all about basically Zionism and the whole situation of how Israel came about in this political situation, and how then Gaza and the militants were reacting against the British, and then the British got kicked out and so on. So if you're interested in this part of the world and interested in the facts, if you like, of what actually has happened, you know, us as a British colony, they've got a lot to bloody answer for. That
doesn't bear thinking about the amount of, you know, as you say, it's who are we to lecture on this when we, our foreign policy over the last not even 100 years, we're going back way, way further than that, is questionable at best. So let's move on to our first guest this week. We're joined by the gentle giant himself, Oliver Freeman, CEO of Golden Metal Resources. Welcome back, Oliver.
Hey, gents, how's it going?
I would say it's the gentle giant with a big snotty nose, no? Is that right, Oliver?
This is a new nickname. I'll have to get used to it, but I like it. It works.
It works well. So great news this week. After the company made a discovery of high-grade gold, silver, copper bedrock at the 100% owned Garfield Project in Nevada, USA, the rock samples obtained from the newly staked ground have yielded remarkable results, with assays returning up to 22.7 grams per ton gold. This finding highlights the presence of a potentially substantial copper, gold, silver deposit spanning an impressive 4 square kilometers area. Tell us more about this discovery, Oliver, please.
Yeah, of course. So, the first thing I'll say is the holidays weren't as restful as I was originally hoping. But what happened here was, you know, we put out some really exciting news at Garfield towards the end of 2023. And the way this project has evolved since we acquired it, each time we keep on looking outside of the current claim boundaries, there's more interest in mineralization alteration that you know, we need to look into. And sure enough, each time we sample it or test it, it seems to come back with high-grade copper, silver, and gold. So once again, we expanded the property, about 6 or 8 months ago, did some work. And then once again, that work delivered, and those are the results we put out in late 2023. But when we looked outside the claim boundary, we saw additional zones that were of interest. And sure enough, we went, took some rock samples there. And to our excitement, those samples delivered. And I think that one of the key takeaways for me is not only the scale now of the mineralization footprint we have, sorry, the mineralized footprint, which is over 4 kilometers, as you mentioned, but the fact that all 5 samples we took from the new ground returned multi-gram gold. You know, typically you grab 5 samples, maybe 1 or 2 will run, but to have all 5 samples run, and I'll just quickly quote the numbers: 5 grams per ton, 7.5 grams per ton, 10 grams per ton, 18.3 grams per ton, and 22 grams per ton. And those all had either high grade or over limit silver, as well as really nice copper grades. So yeah, really excited that we were able to acquire the ground over the holidays while everyone else was eating turkey. We were quite busy, but it was worth it in the end for the ground we have and discovery, the bedrock discovery that we've now made.
Yeah. So, I mean, talk about some of the strategic use of this cutting edge, your geochemical analysis use and the sort of, with the collaboration with, I think it was geochemist Simon Griffiths through the consulting firm 3BX. Just tell how important that is, Oliver, in this process.
Yeah, so Simon is someone that we've been working with on this project for quite some time now. And he's actually the one that originally looked at the soil geochemical database that we acquired and collected back in 2022. And the thing is, when you collect these geochemical databases, I mean, you get, multi-element analysis. You get cadmium, you get bismuth, you get arsenic, you get yttrium, you get all these things. And looking at the different levels and enrichment of various elements and element ratios can tell you a lot about the system that you're looking at. And the average, the average investor will look at, the headline grades, okay, what's the copper, what's the silver, what's the gold, the ones that care about. But there's so much value that you can extract from this multi-element data set. So by having someone as experienced in Simon in the geochemical space look at that data set, what he ultimately found was not only skarn type affinity, which is what we expected to find because we've found actual skarn type rocks, but more importantly, what he discovered or what he outlined was a very substantial porphyry zone. And porphyry deposits are ones that are very important globally for copper, silver, and gold as well. So the fact that we now have defined and clearly confirmed porphyry affinity is really important. And so now what Simon is doing is following up on that. We have now a really robust rock geochemical database. So all the bedrock samples that we took as part of the late 2023 and 2024 program, including the high grade gold from the newly discovered Pamlico gold zone. So he's working through that now, and we'll certainly put out an update to the market once that analysis is complete, as well as in that announcement, we'll include what the next steps are going to be here.
Very good, Oliver. So, I mean, the figures that we're talking about here in terms of add-on gold, and in some ways, maybe it's not even add-on gold, it's just gold in its own right, and the add-on silver are going to make these copper grades pretty phenomenal if this is drilled out and we actually realize the potential of what's in these rock chips. Is that, I mean, it's a bit scary in a way.
Well, it's a good problem to have, Kevin. And the reality is this is a copper first project. We're looking for a copper porphyry here, and we have very strong signs that point to porphyry system being present here. But as you mentioned, you know, and an important note about porphyry, copper porphyry deposits is the copper is the main commodity of interest, but the gold and silver are kind of what are considered kickers. So, you know, when you go and mine these things, you know, the main payable is the copper, but you can get some, you know, the economics improve when you start to look at the silver and gold. So that's kind of how we're looking at these assays. And that's what really blew me away about the gold kicker grades, to see, you know, 22.7 grams per ton gold in a sample that, you know, where we're mostly interested in the copper. That's what's really interesting here is the gold as well as the silver. We had two over limit silvers as well in that newly discovered zone. So once you add these all together, it points to a really exciting story here, which is multi-element now. It's copper, it's silver, and it's gold too, which is really exciting for us.
Yeah, I mean, the silver at above 100 grams per ton is impressive. The gold levels are impressive. But what I suppose was more impressive was I watched your presentation, which basically saw Garfield basically grow from just a small square oblong patch to this huge thing that actually I think looks a bit like the shape of Texas now, in terms of its diagram, obviously not the size, but in Nevada. So do you want to just tell us a little bit about the story of how Garfield has effectively expanded its boundaries over the last few years?
Yeah, of course. And Kev, that technical video that I put out a few days ago, I encourage everyone listening to go have a quick look at that on our Twitter, on my personal Twitter, because it's something that we're doing a bit differently at Golden Metal Resources, really trying to allow our investors and interested parties to get under the hood and start to better understand the technical data that we've been looking at and what has us so excited. But the way that this property has progressed is, as you mentioned, it was a very small kind of oblong patch that we first acquired. It's a really interesting signs on it, which is the reason that we did pick it up. But once again, as I mentioned, every time we look outside the claim boundaries, we're finding more and more mineralization. And surely, you know, we're going to go in there and stake that ground to make sure that we're, you know, adding value for our investors here. And that's exactly what's happened here, is we've now increased the size of Garfield four times over. And once again, each time we look outside of the current claim boundaries, we're finding more and more. And that's obviously a really good problem to have as a CEO and someone who's been around, you know, early stage projects all the way up to kind of resource development. To see a project continue to deliver like this each time we go back is really exciting. And you know, just a note here is First Equity put out a research report today, which outlined a price target of 35 pence. And that only includes value for the in-ground resource at Pilot Mountain, as well as sort of a nominal amount applied for the exploration upside. You know, that report does not include any value for assets like Garfield, which continue to move up the value curve. So I think it just highlights kind of the investment thesis and proposition here at Golden Metal.
Yeah, I think based on what I can see, and obviously we're lower down the trail than Pilot Mountain actually is, but this Garfield project in its own right could challenge Pilot Mountain in terms of its viability and its sheer size and magnitude. Am I on the right lines, or is that just rubbish that I'm talking?
No, I mean, the reality is the reason we have all the assets in the portfolio is because we know in this space, all it takes is, you know, one drill hole to return to shareholders the reason that they invest in this space. You know, we're all here for, you know, the 5, 10, 20x return. We're not here for, you know, 5% per year. You go invest in other spaces for that kind of return. So the reason we have five assets is because we know each one has the potential to deliver that return that we're all here for. So, you know, Garfield is obviously moving up that value curve very quickly. And as you mentioned, it could rival it. Absolutely. We absolutely love Pilot Mountain, and there's a ton of value there. And obviously it's the flagship for a reason. And there's a lot of interest from the US side on that asset for many reasons, but we're going to continue to push Garfield forward, and as well as the other ones. We put out news recently on Gold Comma Summit. We recently put out some exploration updates on Kibby Basin, so there's a lot of other things happening in the portfolio. But yeah, who knows what's going to happen with Garfield, but you know, all we're going to do is continue to push it forward, and if the signs continue to show what they are, then obviously this thing could be add a lot of value here for our shareholders, which is super exciting.
And you're obviously looking around Nevada as well. So there's obviously potential for many of these assets to grow, even in terms of having other opportunities within Nevada.
Yeah, I mean, we always have our ear to the ground. You know, Nevada is, first of all, it's the best ranked mining jurisdiction in the world. But I think more importantly than that is the mineral endowment there. I mean, the amount of metals, gold, that are being mined there, I think tells you all it needs to know about the reason that we're there. So it's a great place to explore, great place to develop and mine as well. So we're really happy about our foothold in Nevada and think there's a lot of potential in the state going forward here.
And it would be remiss of me not ask you, when's the grant coming from the American government for Pilot Mountain?
Yeah, that's the question everyone seems to be asking. Obviously, all I can say is, you know, there's a lot of data points that continue to come out here over the last weeks and months. I've put a lot of them out on my Twitter. One that stood out to me was the depletion of the U.S. defense reserves right now. A lot of the ammunition that they send overseas are totally depleted now. The Defense Logistics Agency stockpiles of tungsten are critically low. So all I'm trying to do here is highlight different data points to the people that are interested in gold and metal. That's kind of all I can do at this stage. But obviously, as soon as I can say something to the market, I will. But unfortunately, I can't say much more than that at this
stage. I didn't expect you to, but I thought I'd put you on the spot anyway.
And other than, I guess, we're in a very unique position with Pilot Mountain. It's the largest tungsten asset on U.S. soil, and geopolitical tensions are, you know, probably near all-time highs here, at least within our generation. So we love the position we're in. We know that this asset needs to move forward. It needs to be, ultimately, the U.S. needs a tungsten that we have in the ground. So one way or another, we're going to find a way to hopefully do that.
Yeah, and just to switch back to Garfield the Cat, what is the situation with copper in terms of grants in the U.S.? Is it seen as a critical metal that it's based in the U.S. itself?
Yes, that's a good question. It was recently added to the Department of Energy, their critical minerals list. So the DOE, I think, has some of the deepest pockets of any U.S. government department. So that's obviously really exciting for us. So it's something that the DOE is now looking at very closely. The DOD is the group that's most interested in Pilot Mountain because tungsten is heavily used in the defense industry. But the DOE is looking at copper quite closely. So there's multiple irons in the fire, so to say, at Gold Medal with the assets we have.
Yeah, and you really could be in a situation, I think, where with a very equivalent high copper grade, if this comes to pass, which would mean that the chances of this being economical is very high. If you start to strike what we hope when the drill bit turns.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, I'm really excited about what we're seeing here at surface. And obviously the next stage is to see how deep and what this looks like at depth. So that's what we're moving towards now. As I mentioned, Simon and myself are working quite closely on really understanding this data set. And then we'll announce what the next steps are going to be. But ultimately, this is moving forward. And it's going to be hopefully drill ready quite soon here. And we're going to find out what lurks beneath, so to say. But what we're seeing at surface is really exciting.
Great. We look forward to speaking to you shortly about whatever else it is you put out. But I would just say to anybody who's listening to this, please, we'll try and put a link in the bottom of this podcast, but please check out the technical thing that Oliver did on Garfield. It's well worth a watch. You can see the progression of Garfield over the number of years and how much bigger it's got, where the gold is and where the copper is, and so on and so forth. Or not where, because they're not in separate places, but there is particular copper thing, there is a particular gold area where we've seen the highs of the gold and the silver. Obviously, there's a hell of a lot more work to be done in that. And as you've said, it continues to expand. So I suggest if you want to get a good grasp of this, have a watch of that. It's well worth it.
Good. Well, I appreciate the plug there, Kevin. I completely agree. I put a lot of time into those videos. And I ultimately, when it comes to this space, it's the technical details that will deliver for shareholders. So that's why we put these things out. We're fully transparent with the data that we have. We really want investors to get a different look than they get by just reading, you know, a typical RNS. So I do also encourage everyone to listen and watch that video. And we'll continue to put those out to highlight the technical details of future RNSs. So thanks for the chat today, gents, and let's chat again soon.
Yeah, and just to reiterate, we'll also put a link to the first equity research note that you alluded to earlier on that was released back end of last week. I think their signing off note on the valuation pretty much summed it up. They said, the market still has not priced in the progress made by GMET since listing, as well as the exciting results achieved recently at Garfield, along with the growing importance of a potential future domestic tungsten asset to the US and high probability that some form of non-dilutive grant funding can be secured within the near term for Pilot Mountain. With these thoughts in mind, we recommend the shares as a buy with a price target of 35 pence per share. So yeah, we'll link that through as well into the bio of this podcast. And Oliver Friesen, CEO of Golden Metal Resources, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Jen.
So moving on to our next guest, we're joined by Charles Bray, Executive Chairman of Aterium. Welcome back, Charles. Hope you're well.
I'm great. Thank you for having me back.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
any new TVs, Charles?
Brand new TV hanging comfortably and proudly on the wall.
Very happy days.
That was a quick fix.
Is it time for the Arsenal match? No, sorry, it's Spurs.
It is. Most definitely Spurs. But visit Rwanda.
So, we sort of seen two announcements, positive announcements this week, Charles. Obviously, yes. The first one was based on the field activities being undertaken by Rio Tinto, and also the signing of a share purchase agreement to acquire a controlling 90% interest Atlantis Metals, a private Botswana-registered entity holding mineral prospecting licenses in the Republic of Botswana. Do you want to just add a bit more color to these two announcements, please?
Yes. With respect to the first one you mentioned, the Rio Tinto JV, we wanted to update the market, and it's not necessarily the easiest thing to discern from the update, but we've made tremendous advances on the ground. We were able to expand quite a bit on the surface mapping to include effectively the entire license area. And we'll be able to update the market on with that in more detail, but that was very positive. What it means is it's allowing us to proceed on to the drilling part, or drilling phase, I should say, of the exploration. And that should occur. I mean, we're formally stating that's going to occur in the first half of the year. We're hopeful that'll be happening a bit earlier, but let's see. And the issues there involve getting the drill rig up the hill, well positioned and in areas so that we can proceed to get the drilling started. And that program looks to be well on the way. And we're very excited about getting the drilling results back out to the market as soon as we can. So positive ground mapping, positive working relationship with Rio Tinto, and really enjoying that learning experience. So we appreciate all of their help and support.
So Charles, as a question, just so people can understand, what is the potential size of this lithium asset? I mean, there's a lot of talk in the market, obviously, at the minute. The lithium price is on the floor. I personally think this is China-based. They want it on the floor so that they can grab as many assets as they can. And I don't think it's going to last, but that's another story. But yeah, how potentially big could this be?
The HCK1 pegmatite is effectively, if you look at it, it's a little hillside. I mean, if you wanted to say, I'm not a geologist, I should state that initially, but if we were targeting 40 to 50 million tons, that to me would be quite reasonable. In terms of the potential size, it could be significantly larger than that.
Okay, great. So Botswana, another country to visit. What's it all about?
Very excited about this. We were able to negotiate the acquisition of 90% of Atlantis Metals, Botswana based company that has four licenses covering approximately 4,000 square kilometers of license area, one copper license in the Kalahari Copper Belt, and three lithium brine licenses in the Suapan region. We have an excellent partner there. He was the owner of Atlantis Metals, and he will be joining us. The total consideration is less than $80,000. It was a bit of a distressed sale, and we're taking the opportunity. I mean, one of the upsides to the markets being, and I'll describe it in French, so crap, has been that there's been a lot of opportunity to acquire cheap assets, and we haven't hesitated to do that. They have a very, very low maintenance cost in terms of maintaining the licenses. We feel very strongly with less than $30,000, $40,000 expenditure per year, we can maintain these licenses and even advance them. And we're hoping to spend more than that, but we'll see based on our cash balances and the other programs. We need to drill in Morocco this year. We have the trading business that we're looking to be launching over the next couple of weeks. And we have exploration activities in Rwanda that are outside of the Rio Tinto joint venture. So quite a bit to do.
I'm going to say, Charles, just tell the listeners how important Botswana is, because we've seen, you know, recent news of the likes of Chinese miner MMG buying, I think it was the Khoemacau copper mine, for something just under $2 billion. And we've also seen the likes of Sandfire and Cobre moving in. So just explain how important the Kalahari Copper Belt is.
It's absolutely a critical area in terms of copper. What you're seeing in those, that acquisition, I think, is the best sign of it, is that, you know, a short 30 kilometers approximately away from our license area, you have the Chinese who've made an acquisition of a copper mine that's going to be producing quite extensively. At least we believe it will be. And given the demand for copper and the fundamentals of copper are stronger than they are with lithium at the moment, just because of the energy transition and the demands put on the need for copper exploration and copper production over the next decade. What we're seeing is that the Kalahari Copper Belt, which the geologists would describe as a well-defined model, has several areas where copper exploration is leading to copper mine development. And we're hopeful that the area, the license area we have, will contribute to that. So there are areas around the world where there are geologically sound, feasible mine production areas. The Kalahari Copper Belt is one of those. We also happen to believe that that soon will be the case with Morocco. The sedimentary deposits we've discovered and are looking to explore are indicating that that's just another area that's a very good jurisdiction, where it's easy to work, where it's easy to transfer money, where it's easy to have legal recourse, all of those things that are required for a good business. It ticks all those boxes in Morocco. It ticks all the boxes in Botswana. So we're very excited.
And you just returned from there, as you alluded to earlier. Just how excited was that? How exciting was the visit? You know, was it fruitful?
I tell you, the amazing thing, every single time I go to Morocco, what shocks me is how there's no overburden. So you literally can just drive out, and we covered some miles, and just see these veins just transversing across the landscape off into the distance. And it's very, very different than what you see in Rwanda, where it's just, you know, not jungle necessarily, but it's heavy vegetation. But Morocco, it's all quite obvious, and the geologists there are so excited, and it was really good to see them again and just hear how excited they are at the prospects and starting the process to engage with a potential partner.
So how excited are you to get the trading arm up and running and have cash flow coming through this business?
I really can't wait. The issue there, you know, we put this off initially. We really want to get this started, launched in January. We have advanced the discussions. We're at the signing stage now with a couple different off-takers, and we're just looking to cross the T's and dot the I's. It's that aspect of it is taking, you know, it's a day here, day longer there. It's so, but I'm still, I stated on last time I spoke with you guys, we want to get that done in January. We're still intent on getting it done in January. So very excited to start trading cassiterite. There's an opportunity for us to secure a coltan offtake as well by the end of the month. And there's even an opportunity for us to potentially trade in some copper concentrate. So things are advancing and we're excited.
Great. So, I mean, just to wrap things up, I mean, basically, you've now moved to three different jurisdictions, three different growth stories, obviously, as we move up the Lassonde curve with all of these. I still think from the point of view of your main deal at the minute is obviously the amount of money that's being spent in Rwanda by Rio Tinto. This is going to add value and you're running up that Lassonde curve basically with the price or with the cost involved for them in terms of what, 30, 40, 50,000 meters of drilling, hopefully that's going to happen in the next period of time. And that should really, from a mining perspective, put you in a different stratosphere than you're in at the minute, especially if you can cover the costs with the trading. And then now we've got both Morocco and Botswana. The issue of the license, the Copper Kalahari license in Botswana, what has actually been done on that ground? Because that's one of the questions that did occur to me that I didn't ask before. Sorry.
Yeah, no, these are all very early stage. There's some preliminary data that we have from historical sources, but these are new licenses that were just issued over the past, definitely within the past year, more along, I'd say about 6 months ago. So not much work has been done. We've relied on some historical working that's been done by the USGS as well. There's been a couple other groups that have been on the ground there. And we have our local country manager who we've just engaged with. He is a geologist and he's building up the team as we speak to start the exploration efforts. And so we're going to be doing some grab samples, some preliminary mapping, all the stuff you do at the initial phase of exploration.
Yeah, but 3,000 to 4,000 square kilometers is not just a few football pitches, is it?
No, it is not. It is a country.
It is a country in many situations.
Yeah. With the Suapan, with the lithium brines, there's, I don't want to say quite a bit, but there's significantly more data in terms of the analysis of some of those reservoirs and what those lithium brines contain. So that we've started working on, and we have some more junior geologist working on that presently. It's the groundwork at the Kalahari Copper Belt. And so Simon and I will be in Botswana later this month to make sure that's progressing well. And
some rocks.
We'll head off to Indaba.
Very good. Well, on that note, we'll say Charles Bray, thanks very much for your time. And we look forward to you coming back on in the future and updating shareholders and listeners with hopefully some exciting news.
Yeah, likewise. Likewise. Thank you both for having me.
Thanks, Charles.
Okay, so let's have a look at the week in markets then. I mean, the first one that I've got on the list is Power Metal Resources. On Friday morning, they had an RNS that was released with that detailed that they'd signed a non-binding MOU with the Ministry of Investment of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, MISA, to explore potential joint collaboration efforts in identifying and realizing high-value investment opportunities related to the kingdom's natural resources. MISA aims to support investment in exploration activities, develop projects targeting various strategic minerals, and attract national and international mining companies to commercialize Saudi Arabia's mineral resources. The MOU allows Power Metal Resources to provide technical support for potential exploration projects, while MISA offers project opportunities and potential support as needed, contributing to the kingdom's vision 2030 and economic diversification. So obviously we know Sean had been out at the mining conference out there this week. So it's good to see news coming out of that, I guess.
Yep. And obviously no effect on the share price, as you would imagine.
That's standard, isn't it, these days?
Yeah, Teck Minerals was also out there. So that's very interesting. There was two of them went, Alex and Lester, who we met at Indaba last year. So yeah, it's very interesting, and I think lots of things are coming into play on in all parts of the world, basically.
Yeah, there's a few others as well. We've got Premier African Minerals. They provided an update on the Zulu Lithium project, revealing recent assay results. Recent surface and drill results showed strong potential in the southeast pegmatite adjacent to the main mining area, with lithium mineralization almost exclusively spodumene. installation of new thickener and mill nears completion, targeting restart of production in early February. So that's one that's got a very big retail following. We also had news on a company we've covered in the past, Emerson. This is the big Moroccan project. The government to deal with the approvals required to progress the potash mine soon. Emerson is awaiting environmental approval from the Ministerial Committee for the Chemiset project, with bank mandates extended 12 months, demonstrating ongoing support. Company has focused efforts on optimizing the project's environmental and economic potential while reducing other technical work streams pending approval. Anything else on your list?
Well, the big mover in all of our stocks that we picked in the 12 stocks of the five gold rings has been Encantera, and we hope to speak to them in the not too distant future. That's moved up from 6.5p to around the 11, 12, 13 pence mark. So,
yeah, saw the news that they'd had there was one of their cornerstone investors who helped with the recent fundraise had increased their position to circa 12%. And there was obviously an interview that we shared on X, which was with Proactive Investor. The chairman, Tim McCarthy, was on, I think it was about a 20-minute interview, very, very lengthy for Proactive. It's nice to see them doing a bit more long form. And he basically talked about the deal with Marinord, how they're kind of funded in the near term, and they're hoping that 2024 is the year for them to reach revenue and let's see, becoming cash positive. So that I thought that was a very good interview. I urge listeners to try and track that one down and have a listen, because I think Tim was very enthused by the deal, wasn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. And if you do the view that they will exponentially increase the production of these skincare products in the second half of the year for the distribution in Europe and Asia, then there is no possibility that this company can stay at the valuation that it is, around £10 million. Mm. It's not possible, because...
What are the risks, though? I mean, what are the absolute worst-case risks? I mean, is that Marinord doesn't make the sales, or that they don't? But surely if they're... Because it's part of the Watson Group, who've got access to like 15,000 stores and 5 billion customers, surely they're going to want to take that product on and do the advertising themselves in-house and really push that product in across the stores. Because from what I understand, this isn't your normal cosmetic. With the oncology side, and the fact that they've got this unique mechanism that allows it to penetrate through the dermatological layer and get to the cells, then surely they've got almost a unicorn in that asset within their range of products that they're selling.
Yeah, I mean, I think the chairman said it well, that they will be training the staff in the different shops in Austria and Switzerland initially.
Yeah.
And then that rollout will continue throughout Europe. You know, I think it could go into tens of thousands of stores. You know, it's not a small number of stores that they're going to be able to go into. So, you know, you consider that they were able to sell, you know, one bottle in each store every week, for the sake of argument. How much product would they sell in the year? You know, it's absolutely ridiculous numbers, you know, ridiculous. From the conversations we've had, you're talking about, you know, millions and millions and millions, tens of millions probably, of profit, certainly towards the end of 2024. And then if it goes as they anticipate, which obviously is the risk, then, you know, I think you could be talking many factors of that amount again in 2025. So what is a company worth with that sort of potential explosive growth? That's got to be the question you've got to ask. It seems like this company would not have taken on this product if they didn't think it worked. It seems to have the legitimacy. It works. It helps. And then I suppose the blue sky for this company is then that the delivery system and their ability to help people then goes to a pharma base. And they then start looking at products that are in the pharma industry, as opposed to just the skincare, which is what they're doing at the minute. But I mean, we found this basically over Christmas, and having spoken to Suzanne, who seems to be extremely professional, very switched on in terms of what she's doing. And yeah, I think, you know, this is just one of those things that comes out the blue that you think, wow, this could really be, you know, something else. And that, I mean, we'll openly say we've bought in the market a couple of times.
I'm not excited about ones like this, but you say that you've got to go into it with a risk off as well. You know, you've got to say there are inherent risks with any type of investment, but ultimately the upside in it is huge in this kind of cosmetic space. And the fact that when you look at Watson as a group, they are the biggest cosmetic retailer in the world, and then not just the world, but in the sense that they are focused on the Asian market, which is massive. So very exciting on that. Yeah, absolutely. I think we've just got to keep an eye on it and see how things progress.
And if you fundamentally look at the risk is they might need more cash, but if it's for cash to upscale and produce even more product, is that bad cash? No, for sure it's not bad cash. It's going to be tremendous cash. And secondly, the product just does not sell. People don't want it. I find that hard to believe. I find that that this company, from what the chairman said, not what we're saying, had basically approached them because they had this space in this market that they wanted this type of product. They have the product and it has a unique selling point.
And the other good thing is Marion Odd haven't got an exclusivity on it. So it doesn't just mean that they're now that they've signed that agreement deal, that they're tied in with Marion Odd. So effectively, if they wanted to hit, say, the North American market, they could go into the likes of Walgreens or, you know, AN other pharmacy/ cosmetic reseller into the American, Canadian, market. And even in EMEA as well, you know, obviously they've got the Switzerland and the Austrian rollout in place with Frika. But there's no reason why they couldn't go with another reseller in the North American market.
No, the potential is massive. And as you say, it's hard not to get excited about the thing. But we set up a group on Telegram. We're in conversations with the company and with Suzanne. And let's hope it fulfills its promise. Because, I mean, the promise right now looks like it's incredibly good. And it could certainly make our gold rings extremely golden.
So we saw some news on Bitcoin this week. What news? Well, what we saw was obviously a sharp rise in the price volatility following an approval of several spot Bitcoin ETFs by the US Securities and Exchange Commission on Wednesday of this week. A spot Bitcoin ETF is a financial product that investors hope will open the gateway for mainstream capital to flood the crypto market. So on Wednesday, the SEC approved ETF applications from some of the biggest names on Wall Street. We saw BlackRock and Franklin Templeton, and also JP Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs have offered to help these asset managers in creating and redeeming shares for their new Bitcoin-based funds. Bitcoin trading volume surged as the first 10 US ETFs offering direct exposure to Bitcoin made their long-awaited debut on stock exchanges. Trading in these ETFs and Grayscale investments converted $28 billion. Bitcoin Trust exceeded $4 billion across various exchanges a day after receiving the approval. Grayscale's Bitcoin ETF accounted for about half of the action, with BlackRock's iShares Bitcoin ETF also experiencing significant trading. So what do you make of that news?
Bitcoin's going to go up.
Yeah, it already has.
It's sort of an inevitable. Yeah. Will Bitcoin, you know, will some of these whales who hold a lot of Bitcoins cash in on this option again and take the price down again? I think that could happen. But I'm no expert on Bitcoin, but what it does do, for sure, is open the market that the guy who's never going to touch Bitcoin in his life,
because he put a seal on it and said you can hold it in ETFs, then effectively they're saying we're okay with it, really, aren't we?
Yeah. One other thing just to mention that came on the market was Charles Archer wrote a vlog stroke report on chill brands. And we've also recorded a podcast with him and Callum Sumpton, the CEO. So watch out for that. Have a read of the note. I thought it was very comprehensive and very good. And watch out for the podcast next week.
So three things I've seen this week, moving on to something a bit more lighthearted. So I know people in this industry, and I know people in other industries who do things for a lot of people, helping people along, whether it be charitable work, whether it be helping recover from addictions, etc. One thing, and I've seen them comment on this person and say, I thought I was helping people, but until I saw what this person did for others around the world, I was absolutely blown away and I feel almost insignificant. And it was basically, I went to see the movie One Life at the theaters this week, and this is based on the true story of Sir Nicholas Winton, who was a young London stockbroker who, in the months leading up to the Second World War, he rescued 669 predominantly Jewish children from in Czechoslovakia. And it's a phenomenal story. I mean, until his death in probably, I think it was like early 90s, not many people knew the story of it. And it's only in the mid-80s that when he was clearing his house out, that basically the media got hold of the story. It was actually Robert Maxwell's wife, who was a Jew herself, who actually found about the story of him because he was clearing out. One of his friends offered his kind of archives out, and she found the story and she invited him to talk. And then he basically was then moved on to the program. You might remember it with Esther Ranson. It was called That's Life in the sort of mid-80s, where she used to talk about charitable things people did. She invited Nicky Winton onto the show and basically told his story about them saving all these Jewish children who he shipped over to various families in the UK. And sat next to him was one of the children that he'd saved as an adult. And it's honestly the most tear-jerking thing you can ever see. And what a phenomenal story. If you want a feel-good movie, take some hankies with you to the cinema, because you guarantee you'll need them. You'll be a blubbing wreck when you get out of it. But what a phenomenal story. So that's well worth looking. Nicky Winton and Nicholas Winton is played by Anthony Hopkins, probably one of the greatest actors that we've seen in our lifetime. And yeah, absolutely. You've got to go out and see it, Kev, when you're over. I'm sure it'll come to Egypt. God, please go and see it. I know you'll love it.
Yeah. No, the Maxwells are connected in many, many different ways. Part of that podcast that I talked to you about before will show you how connected the Maxwells were. I mean, they're a Jewish family.
Yeah.
And he changed his name many times.
Fortunately, he ended up in the Mediterranean, didn't he, Robert Maxwell? As we know, during the times of the Mirror Sun scandal, wasn't it? And the kind of the warring between that. No one knows what exactly happened. There's still a lot of mystery surrounding the death of Robert Maxwell. But certainly that, again, is back onto our original point of how do the media actually come out with some positives? Well, I guess that the fact that she was happy to get behind Nicky Winton and tell his story was phenomenal. And he affected something like 6,000 families, because a lot of these went on to obviously have families. So their impact was felt. It wasn't just the 669 children, obviously their families, they had families. Many, many other people's lives were affected by it. And he was a stockbroker. He was literally working in London, and he leveraged his connections in the city to be able to raise finances. And he created a scrapbook of all the children. I'm not going to go too much more, because there's so many more things that you'll learn in the story of Nicholas Winton, but definitely urge you to see it. I also saw Ferrari, which is the life of Enzo Ferrari, which for any car nuts is an absolutely astonishing story. Penelope Cruz plays his wife. Adam Driver plays Enzo as well. It's just a phenomenal story, the passion that this guy...
I think I might go and see it just for Penelope Cruz, to be honest.
Yeah, oh, she's outstanding. Yeah, and great eye candy. And also saw Wonka with the kids, obviously very lighthearted, about Willy Wonka during the early days. Again, a great, and it's a musical, fantastic. Your kids would absolutely love it, Kev. So again, take them to that if you get the opportunity. But I think on that note, unless you want to add anything else, we'll wrap up our first roast of season 7 and say thanks for listening, and hit the subscribe and smash the like button.
Yeah, thanks for listening, guys. Speak to you next week.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.